Hey, before we hop into the podcast, I want to let you guys know that this is a re-release from Season 1, Episode 23, the story of Upstream Farms, brothers Matt, Joe, and Emmy, how they're taking the family farm over and moving it in a new direction. Really is a fascinating story that we wanted to revisit, tell again, because I'm pretty sure we're going to have Matt, Joe, and Emmy back on the podcast soon enough. So before we did that, we wanted to kind of step back and retell the Upstream Farm story, because we do get our beef from these guys. And we're a little tied up right now on the ranch, on the farm. I know Ben and Morgan are going in different directions. I'm as well up on our family ranch right now in Boyd County, Nebraska. I got a lot of things going on this weekend. So without further ado, let's get to it. Season 1, Episode 23.
Sun rolling over, acres of farmland, shining the light on the world I grew up in. No name, dirt roads about to get tore up, all going down in a town you never heard of.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Common Folk Podcast with Ben, Morgan, and Andy.
All right, welcome to Common Folk.
Hey, we're back at it.
Here we are.
Now, hold on. I like doing this.
That's yes. Like your signature move.
I just think it sounds right. It's like business time. It's podcasting time.
Yeah, I'm already half done. Well, you're late to the show.
I can try and catch up. Okay. I think I can do it.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah.
No, Ben, where are you at in that drink over there?
I just opened it.
Okay.
I'm hot, though, so I'm going to drink a lot, probably.
Oof. We got the cooler ready.
It's freaking hot in here today.
We do, yeah.
Well, in here, but also outside. Well, it's like 97. Yeah.
Oh, at least.
I mean, it's almost like a spiritual experience. You're like hotboxing it in the podcasting room. Well, not hotboxing it like that. Jeez. You know what I mean?
Like, that's like, are you serious?
It's like a yoga type thing. I don't know. I don't know.
I was like, yeah. Who's like, farting?
You're, yeah,
or
you're
what?
Saying, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't
We're just
going
to sweat
yeah.
it out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a sweat box. Sorry. That doesn't sound better to
no,
me.
No, it doesn't. You and Ben are kind of matching today. I know some of these folks can't see this, but it's a little off. Yeah. I didn't get the memo or what?
Well, it's the same like tone, isn't it? Like
yeah, that's
an earthy
true.
Tone.
Yeah, we're actually yeah. all, right. We have guests here.
We do. We got a full room here.
What are we doing? Always have to remind ourselves.
There's six in here today, not three.
It's a lot.
So yes. Who do we got here today, Ben?
So we have the folks from Upstream Farms, Joe, Matt, and Emmy.
Emmy with a E-M-I.
Right, yeah. E-M-I.
Yeah, yeah.
We found this out. Because I would have thought it was E-M-M-Y or E-M-M-I.
Yeah.
Emmy was a last second tag along too, because she wasn't even going to come today. And then when we were going to do this, she was going to go do some errands. And then last second, we're like, Emmy, you just stick around. She's been as big of a part of our story as anybody. So
for sure.
Got her talked into sticking around. So
yeah.
Got a crowded room here.
So awesome. To give a little bit of perspective, Matt and Joe, twin brothers, right?
Yes, sir.
So who's technically older?
Joe is actually, but it was a C-section, so it was super fast.
Okay.
30
so
seconds.
Like, that's what I was going to say. So then it almost doesn't count.
He doesn't have it by much.
Not by much, but 30 seconds is 30 seconds older, so he's always got 30 seconds of wisdom on me.
Figures, yeah.
Does he pull that card when you guys are doing chores and stuff?
Not really. I mean, but we used to be that way, but he can still beat me up, which is crazy because he's a little smaller than me. But like when we're going, like when we used to fight, he would just go crazy and I couldn't do it. I was like, he's a really good fighter.
He's, so. I mean, he's shorter than
shorter
you,
than me. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. But like the kid,
he's got a little bit of size
he's
on
built.
You.
Right? Yeah.
So that, Joe, you work out.
Is that
out.
Some sort of fat joke, Ben?
No. No,
so
I'm not
work
shaming.
Out.
Yeah. We no, that's a I don't know, you know, you talk about like being older, but I mean there's a big maturity difference, I think.
Not the truth.
And then Emmy is my sister-in-law, Joe's wife. And like I said, when we started Upstream and we started the vision of Upstream, I mean, we were already going by the time you guys had met, but like when we got into the nitty-gritty of it, Emmy was a huge part of that process. So I figured she could probably add some insight. So I appreciate you sticking around.
Yeah, we're going to have to hand the mic over there here pretty soon.
Absolutely.
So what I wanted to start with was, first of all, what is Upstream Farms? So people can get some perspective on that. And then let's dig in a little bit to how all that's going and what you guys are doing.
Absolutely. So, like our, I don't know, our tagline or pitch or whatever, the mouthful of whatever Upstream is we like to say we're twin brothers farming in the Midwest, putting new ideas on old dirt, and then connecting our customers back to the land one meal and beverage at a time. So that is like our little 10 second spiel or whatever.
That's
we
a
have
good
to say.
Elevator speech right there. Yeah, I'm sold. So
if I ever meet like some big wig in an elevator in Vegas or something like that, I'm said, this is what we do. But really what that is our goal is to take commodities that we're raising as farmers, because we grew up on a farm, and after college we returned to that farm, and we just want to see a space in agriculture where we can take what we grow, turn it into a value-added product, sell it back to a consumer, and build a relationship with that consumer as their personal farmer. So we want to see a world down the road where people used to have, like, you know, their mailman or the milkman or their personal hairstylist. We want to be able to provide that relationship with the customer and put that face back with the farmer. And then we think that that hopefully we'll see other young farmers doing that and create a different way to do agriculture, not necessarily the only way to do agriculture, but just different way of thinking when it comes to, rather than just expanding in terms of acres, we can vertically integrate and expand in that way. Mm-hmm. So that's really what we're doing. But I mean, another thing is storytelling. I mean, there's a story to be told in agriculture, and we enjoy doing that. So that's the other half of it, is just a creative outlet for us to tell a story that happens in agriculture every day. So.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I really love about what you guys are doing, and what had first attracted me to your guys' brand and what you have going on is that storytelling. And frankly, I'm surprised that you guys aren't bigger on like social media and stuff like that than you actually are. Not that you're not, but with the content that you create and the story that's told, it's like, I just feel like once people really discover it, it's going to get pretty crazy. I don't know if that's how you guys feel, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's nuts, because like the space of content, and this is a whole nother rabbit hole we could get down in, but it's really, I mean, you can create the best content in the world, but if and just document all you want, but it's those outlets, you know, there's different...
If nobody sees it,
exactly,
then what?
Exactly. There's different media platforms that get saturated and other ones that have that space, and then also as we become more responsible farm owners and we've taken on more responsibility on the farm, creating that content has been a whole nother, whole nother beast, and so... But with that, we've still been able to grow our brand in different ways, more word of mouth and things like that, which has been super interesting. So we found that as we've grown, but we still, I mean, every day I get to get on and I get to engage with some of our people in the social realm. It's like, it's super fun.
Yeah.
Well, and I feel there's a growing desire for the consumer to get back to that one-on-one experience, to actually buy from the farmer, from the butcher. When did that light bulb go off for you guys that, hey, this might be something that people want, you know, to hear the story, meet the people, and then do business with them?
I don't know if there was actually like a one time that happened. I think that we started our kind of entrepreneurial, you know, journey in the Engler Entrepreneurship Program at UNL. I mean, from the time we were in high school, I guess you could go back to say that we were really involved in our community. You know, we would, as high schoolers, freshmen and sophomores in high school, we'd go to economic development meetings in our hometown of Albion because we just really cared about the community. We always felt supported, whether it was through sports in high school or whatever we were doing. We felt that support and we loved our hometown. We loved our community. We always wanted to give back in some way. And when we went to the Engler Entrepreneurship Program at UNL, we found ourselves going down rabbit holes trying to start businesses just because we wanted to, because that's what you know, you were there to start a business. And so, you know, we explored a lot of different things. And when we came back to it, what we really wanted to do was just provide a business that could support our hometown and just give back to our hometown in some sort of way. And so we see what we're doing as an intersection of, you know, this creativity that Matt and I have, which is, you know, we grew up in the music. My mom was a piano teacher, and it was weird, you know, you didn't, in a small town, you kind of do a bunch of different things. We were in band, but we were also on the football team. And so it's just like, you do get this whole rounded experience. And so we actually ended up at UNL, not only being in the entrepreneurship program, but we were in the UNL drumline and in the UNL marching band and did things like that. So we had this diverse passions, you know, very diverse passions that we wanted to create a business that was based around those passions and was kind of the intersection between, you know, this really creative outlet, but also agriculture, which we were obviously also very passionate about. So.
Yeah, and I mean, just to go off of that too, I mean, we also, just like in more practical terms, we grew up you know, eating with a freezer full of beef. And that was the first thing. We were like, I remember one time we went, when we first went to college, the first beef that I ever ate, and this is no lie, that wasn't cooked in a restaurant, but just like buy it, cook it on a grill, was, that wasn't from our farm, was in college. I went to Hy-Vee, and sorry, I don't know if I should, if you guys are sponsored by Hy-Vee or anything like that. But
I went to Hy-Vee. Or Kroger.
Yeah.
Get them out of Kroger all the way.
But I, and I grabbed a steak, and I was just like, and we cooked it, and I thought I messed it up. And then we went home, had the same steak, and I was like, oh, it's the beef.
It's the beef.
It's the beef.
There's a difference. Yeah.
And so, and that was when we first like, okay, there's got to be more people out here that are looking for good beef. So that was like the more practical, that's how we decided to go direct to consumer. But like the more, like out there, the realm was like, let's do something in agriculture that is a little bit different, you know, a little more creative. So,
and I love that.
I mean, that the route that you guys have, are taking has to be so much harder, but on the other hand, more rewarding.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it is.
Pass the mic.
It's interesting because Matt alluded this a little bit earlier, but we've taken on more of a farming role. And we talked about this before we started the podcast, that we'll touch on this. We don't have to dwell on it. But our and I think that this is something that happens a lot in agriculture that you just don't hear about. But our family dynamic has switched since our parents got a divorce. And so Matt and I are now farming more of we're taking on more of a role in the farm. We're farming our mom's ground after they got after they split. And so, you know, that was something that was unexpected. We'd started our business with our family farm, the farming operation kind of being taken care of. We were kind of hired help. And we were doing, you know, whenever, you know, the family farm needed help, we would pitch in, but it gave us a lot of time to work on our business. And so it's interesting because we've had to learn how to be good business owners and farmers. Mm-hmm. And to say that that's been extremely hard and been a really tough year is an understatement, because we're juggling a lot of things more than what we had thought we would ever have to this early in our lives.
So this is super fresh then? This just...
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's the last 18 months. It's been a part of what happened. So we went from being full-time business owners, part-time farmers, basically, where we were a part of a huge family dynamic, and everything on those day-to-day chores and everything like that, we got to be a part of it. We got to document it, have it be a part of our lives. But then, and you know, when I say full-time business owners, we were selling all the beef that we raised direct to consumers. We were sourcing pork from other farms and selling that, as well as honey. And then on top of that, Joe went to distillation school. We renovated an old milk barn on our farm, turned it into a distillery, and we were filling barrels full of whiskey with the grain that we raise. And so we were sitting there, you know, that's all, we were doing all of that day to day. And then, you know, chores, planting, harvest, all those things. We're a part of that, but we didn't have to do it ourselves. Here in the last 18 months, we've been doing both.
So is this where Emmy's really come up big for you guys, where you guys are working in your business, she's working on your business now? Is that kind of where you've really been able to help?
Yeah, it's kind of been like, you know, the last 2 years, I remember like the first night we irrigated by ourselves and we had to go start the wells, and we stayed up all night watching those darn things because we didn't know what was going to happen. And when we got them started, it was amazing. And so just having to balance the business and the farming side of it, doing everything of all of it, has been a balancing act, but I think we're getting pretty good at it. And now we're just finding what we're both good at. And so, you know, Matt can sell the heck out of a beef, but I can go organize the freezer maybe a little bit better. And so just finding where we fit. And so, you know, I'm not on the farm full time. I'm a mental health counselor. And so I get to hang out when I can and provide a little feedback sometimes.
That's all right.
Yeah, right. So yeah, it's just finding where we all fit. And so it's been fun. I don't know if I would use fun the last 6 months before, but it's been a journey, and we're starting to find the fun of everything. And
I'd say as far as farming and everything that you guys have going on, having a mental health counselor on staff.
Hello. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Like, jeez.
You know, you guys, like, maybe
we should have these guys on every month.
like, how does that make you feel? You think, like, maybe we should just take a step back? Like, you guys are kind of quiet. Like, what happened when you went to go irrigate? Like, what's going on? So, yeah, it's been a whirlwind.
The truth is, in what we do at Farm Focused and with all these different brands that we work with, there's a ton of them that get on these mental health kicks, I guess you'd call it, you know, where they're trying to get behind, you know, whatever that month is, and they're really trying to bring things to the forefront and help people understand that this is what's going on in farming, and this is what's going on with farm families, and so on and so forth. And it's a really serious thing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool to have that in your guys's corner.
agriculturists just, they get left in the dust sometimes, and then they have this attitude of pull it up by your bootstraps and everything's going to be fine. And the neighbor's growing the corn, they're growing the soybeans. We must be able to do that. They look like they're doing a good time. They're getting the same amount of rain as we are. They're paying the same inputs. We should all be fine. And it's just not, that's not the reality. And so I think just bringing some more highlight to that of everybody has bad days, everybody has good days, and everybody struggles, and just sometimes a little bit more than others. I think that'll be, I like where we're going in society of bringing more light to that, because we definitely need it.
And without spending too much time on it, but to continue to touch on what's important there, the other thing is the lifestyle, you know, so you're very secluded, you know, I mean, yeah, you can run to town, you can do these kinds of things. Most farmers aren't getting to come and sit down and do a podcast and chat with people and do the kinds of things that you guys are doing. But this is how you guys have built your business, you know, to work directly with people. Mm-hmm. Most farmers are working with their local co-op or their elevator or whatever. They're not seeing, you know, people from outside their realm. And that's a huge piece of that mental piece that you're talking about.
The co-op doubles as the coffee shop. I know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that that's what's important for us too, is, you know, we get to have this diverse experience by starting this business. We get to be out with folks like yourself and be able to come chat with you guys. And I think it's just as important for us as it is for our customers, because it's what we love doing. It's important for us to be able to do things like this, and we're passionate about it. So.
Yeah.
Have you guys always, so you went to college together, you played sports, were in the band together. Have you ever like separated?
Honestly, it's crazy. Not really. I mean, we didn't live together. We didn't live together. Like the first time that I remember didn't do anything together was our freshman year of college, where he decided to live like three dorm rooms down from me. And that was crazy. Like, because we had lived under the same roof our whole lives. And then even after that, you know, he moved with some of his friends. He got to be close with some guys in the agronomy. We went in different ways in terms of our degrees that we pursued when we were there. I went after the animal science side. That's what I was passionate about. Okay. Joe went off the agronomy side, and we figured that was a diverse way to come back to the farm, you know, and so that was a good diversity, good way to go, but also allowed us to kind of branch out and do things differently and learn different specialties. So we're out of each other's hair a little bit. So he got friends in that space. I got friends in my space, and we lived in different places throughout college. And then once we moved back from college, we moved into my great grandpa's farmhouse, and we lived together. And then when Emmy, Emmy joined the whole crew right during that time. Emmy moved in too, and so we were all under the same house, and that was so fun. Now Emmy's got to talk.
So that was during COVID, and we didn't have a choice. No, we did have a choice. It was great for a while, and I said, Joe, if you want to like still be in a relationship with me, we should probably find somewhere else to live. So we did break up with Matt.
No offense, Matt. You're great. Matt. It's me, not you.
Right. And we didn't move too far away, so we're all in the same area now. But so, it was good times.
When you guys were at school and it was your freshman year, I imagine like the dorms that we lived in where there's like this commons area in the middle. There's dorms across from each other. We were in Lincoln. We were at...
lived in Smith.
We were in Harper.
We were in Harper.
Okay, yeah. So were you guys like you guys were in different buildings? So like, did you like put things up in your window like, hey, I miss you, picture or something? Like,
we weren't in different buildings. We were like three doors down from each other. We were still under the same roof, just not living in the same room.
I guess.
But I mean, even with that, I mean, I think our mom was really good about always making sure that we remained two separate people our entire lives. With twins, I think that's easy to not do that. It's easy to get really codependent. And while we still struggle with that sometimes, you know, when an example of that, like when we were in high school and playing football or whatever, I could have a really good game and Matt could have a really crappy game, and I would still feel like shit, because I'd be like, oh man, like he didn't have a good game, and that just completely brought down that's just a good example of what happens a lot within, you have this, what affects him affects me. People are like, oh, if I pinch you, does he feel it? And it's like, well, no, but you know, it's one of those things where if having that dynamic, and I think that there's a lot of siblings that can relate to that, you know, just being able to, if you have really close to your siblings, things that happen to them, you know, you feel those things as if they were happening to you. And so, you know, we've had to learn how to balance that in our business, being in business together and being partners, not just brothers, you know. And I think it's challenging, but it's also extremely rewarding, because, you know, we can really bounce off of each other, and it's been a really big benefit for our business.
I think that even with relationships. I mean, you guys will see that the longer. I mean, we've been together since we were 16. I mean, you start feeling that too. So that you say brothers or siblings, sometimes I'll be like, oh, he doesn't look like he's having fun. So. You know, I mean, I don't know if that's a thing that you would agree with, Ben, but I feel like probably. It's, I don't know.
Ben's like, I'm not touching that.
Anyway, so
that's another thing that you'll learn as you get older. It's like, you just agree. It's like, yeah, it's all good.
Okay.
I'm with you.
Yeah. But on the real though, you grew up having the same experiences. Yes. You're gonna feel things in a certain way.
Yeah.
And that's something we've worked through. And even this last year, you know, like I said, to say that it has been like a super easy year, no bumps in the road, would be a lie. I mean, you know, a lot of people, when you go through farming, you, and I'm sure a lot of your guys' listeners, is, I'm assuming primarily a lot of farmers.
A lot of it's agriculture folks, sure.
Agriculture folks. And if you're not from that space, the dynamic of coming back to a family farm, it has a lot to do with, you get to learn a lot. So like you have, you know, until the time, let's say you start farming, you're back on the farm full time till you're 20. And let's say you move all the way back, you know, all the way till you're 40, you're still farming. And then maybe whoever's in charge of that space steps out of there when they're like 80 years old. People wonder why there's so much generational lag in agriculture. It's because of that.
Yeah.
People don't retire at 50. They retire at 80 to 90 or even later.
When they can't walk.
When they can't walk anymore. Yeah. They physically can't do it.
Right.
And so the thing is a little bit different with our experiences is that a lot of those things that we, when we decided to kind of jump into this space where we're full-time farmers too, we're getting baptized in fire. So it was a lot of just letting your pride down and being like, I don't understand this. You know, I feel like I should understand this, but I don't. And so when something breaks down or our fence doesn't get fixed correctly and there's those day-to-day things that need to be done or the chores don't get done correctly and it just, you know, doesn't work out. You know, we've had to learn from that and be very intentional about learning from that. And then in the same time, you still got three emails in your inbox of people wanting beef and somebody wanting that. Yeah. And you have to deal with that when the sun goes down.
Yes.
And so we just had to work harder and a little bit smarter and not have quite as much pride.
Well, and it's not even that. I think that there's a point in our lives where we made a decision that, you know, we wanted to be involved with the farm. But, you know, there are some kids that are our age who were taking on a lot more responsibility, but we decided to go a different route. You know, we wanted to do our own thing. And so there are kids at our age who probably are farming and that's what they're doing, but they do know more about it. And so in our minds, you know, we're perfectionists. We want to be good at the things that we do and we want to do everything in a quality manner. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard to, you know, go into that when you've been, you know, instead of learning how to completely overhaul a tractor, I was learning how to run a still and going to, you know, school to learn how to do that. And so some of those things that normally kids that grew up and they were all in on the farming thing would already know how to do some of the things that we were still learning how to do. So it is one of those things you have to let down your pride a little bit and be like, hey, because we decided to launch a business instead of going all in on the farm, we had to relearn some of those things.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the things that, and I do a lot of sports broadcasting and that's kind of been a big part of my upbringing and who I am. A lot of blowback that coaches get is when they fire in a complete staff and they bring in their own guys. And they, you know, a lot of people look down on that. Oh, he's a good coach. He's a good coach. Why'd you fire him? And I am on the other side of it. I like that because when you're the head coach and you bring your guys in, you're responsible for them and you care for them. And then they also, they bring it back to you. They know they need to win. Mm-hmm. You know, like they owe you the job, you know, their livelihood. So I feel it's the same dynamic here where you guys are on the same page. Even if you're not on the same page, you know you got to make it work, right? Your farm's on the line, your livelihood. And it's the same in coaching. When you bring your guys in, it's all or nothing,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
And so I feel like you guys have that dynamic right now. And that's why, you know, I think it's a big part of why you've been able to thrive and grow your business.
Yeah, on the way here, we actually had a conversation of, look at us. We're making some good decisions. We're all on the same page because we're not always all on the same page. And we have to sit down and have long conversations, but today, yesterday, we've been on the same page. So it's just, it's, you know, it is a family operation. We all are striving for the same success. And so we all have to, you know, if somebody's a little bit lower, we have to pick that person up. And so it's just taking the time to hear everybody out and figure out what our goals are going to be.
Yeah. And someone might forget some beef too, but.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and that's a great example. Like, you know.
Sorry, just had
Matt
to.
Matt let him these, off the hook.
These guys here at Farm Folk has bought some beef from us and it's great. I mean, because they have been buying beef, but sometimes, you know, stuff, we all have strengths and we all have weaknesses.
I'm kidding.
And,
you.
over there. You know, no. It's actually a really good thing to bring up because it's kind of a little bit of an example of a bigger of what our years look like, which is the reason why. And like you can go all the way back. Is I texted Ben. We were running a little late today, and I was like, you know, sorry, we're running late. Our irrigation wells didn't want to start up today this morning. You know, and
we know that's life.
It's
like,
life.
Stuff
it
happens.
Just happens. But then that was a result of me rushing while I was filling up our vehicle or delivery truck with beef, and then I get there and two boxes aren't there that should have been there, and so that's kind of like like I said, a perfect example of why, like, balancing this. I'm a full time farmer, and it's crazy to me that some days I look around what we're doing and I'm like, it was crazy to me because 2 minutes ago I was working cattle covered in manure. I literally got dressed, cleaned up, and I'm in Omaha 2 hours later to do beef deliveries. And I like get done with that day and I turn around, I'm like, wow, like 8 hours ago I was literally covered in cow manure and now I'm like in Omaha. And I know that's like a weird example, but it's just we've had to kind of struggle with that dynamic of, okay, we want to be good farmers, we want to do that correctly, and so while you're trying to do that, what do you drop, you know, what ball do you drop? Mm-hmm. We're actually in a cool spot right now though, where we're finally getting the opportunity where it feels like there's a light at the end of it, because we're getting to a point now where we can hire people and we can bring people on board and we can expand this past ourselves, which I think is a huge thing for us personally. We started this too. I mean, we're talking about why, you know, why did mm-hmm. we start this? A big part of it was, one, help agriculture, find a way to diversify, bring in multiple sources of revenue, and create more of a stability in small farms, you know, and that was first and foremost what we wanted to do. But another thing was a motivation was to hire people. We want to build a team to kick mm-hmm. ass with, you yeah. know, mm-hmm. just build a team of people and let's every day show up and let's do our job. Let's do it really well. And that was one thing that killed me about the last 18 months is like, I was doing everything and all of it half-assed, and all of us were like, that's mm-hmm. what it felt like. Mm-hmm. Now, what were we actually?
No, probably absolutely not.
You're never going to be harder on you're harder on yourself than anybody yes. else is, but it felt that way at times. And so when we're going through those ebbs and flows, you know, now finally when you get to bring somebody on board, and finally we had this kid approach us, and we honestly, it was a good thing he approached us, because we're the kind of people where we just work a little harder. You know, you don't hire somebody, just work a little yeah. harder. And not a great mentality to have, just for anybody out listening. It does not fare well. You will burn out. And so finally this kid from the local grocery store shows up and he's just like, hey guys, I want a job. I love what you're doing. I want to work for you. And we walked away and we were kind of like, okay, yeah, we're not going to do that. And then we sat down and thought about it. And we're like, no, we can't afford to do this. And then the more I thought about it, we're like, we can't afford not to. Mm-hmm. And so finally we're in this space where we can bring more people in and we can start to grow. And it feels really good. And for so sure. It was just, like I said, you went through that 18 months of learning everything. And now it feels like that we're kind of gotten. And I think that was what Emmy was alluding to on the way here. We were driving down the road and Emmy's like, man, feels different. Feels good. Feels like we're kind of getting our shit together. Well, and then I forget all our beef. So.
Well, yeah. And that's, and you led me right into it. It's going to feel really good to blame that kid for missing the beef. Not you. It's his fault.
No, I think that's true. I mean, I think that you can look at any family business. I remember one of the most beneficial classes I ever took in college was family business, because it gave me a perspective that, you know, hey, you're not the only one out there that deals with some of these things, that, mm-hmm. that these changes will affect you. And it doesn't matter if it's farming, any family business, I think that you're going to have to deal with a lot of raw emotion that you wouldn't have to deal with in any other business. And it does. It's whether it's your partner, your wife, you know, whatever it is, your husband, it's you're going to deal with things that normal business owners don't have to deal with. But there's a reward to it that you just can't put mm-hmm. a price on.
Yeah.
And so I think by being able to bring in different people and add to our so-called family and treat them in the same way that we treat each other and figure that out, I think we're going to have a really cool team down the road that can help us get to where we want to go and achieve some of the goals that we're trying to get to. So,
yeah.
Now, if you're not comfortable, you don't have to answer or whatever, but I was curious, how many head of cattle do you guys run?
So before the split, I guess you could say, we had mm-hmm. about 300 head of purebred Angus cattle.
And so 600 pairs at the...
Well, yeah, there were 600 cattle, you know, mm-hmm. and then they would all have, you know...
Right, 300 pairs is what
heifers.
I meant.
Yeah, 300 okay. pair. Yep, exactly. And so, and then the way we raise our beef is from conception all the way through finishing. Mm-hmm. We are completely vertically integrated in that space. And you're seeing that kind of go away a little bit. You're seeing more people just kind of, you know, you're seeing this space where we're getting more specialized, which I think there's benefit to that. But for us, we like to have a hand in every part of the process. Not only do we raise the cattle and their calves and finish all the way through the process, but we also raise everything they consume. So the hay, the corn, the feed, all the forages and feeds, the pasture land, everything like that. We've got 100% control over that. And to me personally, I think that has a lot to do with raising good beef. I mean, I don't want to get too technical here, and we can edit this out if I do, but
go for it.
There you go. Just mute me right now.
He's the editing guy, so okay.
But there's a whole
wrap it up.
Get her done. Let's go.
No,
but
I'm kidding.
There's a lot of studies out there that say that there's things called genetic conditioning in the second trimester when a calf is about to be born, and that impacts the quality of the meat.
Right.
All the way at the end.
Yeah.
You know,
well, let's just say something's different about you guys' beef. I mean, we always talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's it.
Well, it has something to do with it. I think that there's a lot to, and you know, and I will also say, I think I've always said this, if you're buying right from a farmer, you know, you have less hands on it, you have less places where there's less chances for, you know, that the shelf life. It's a more direct process.
Okay.
And so I think that you're going to enjoy that process more than when you buy right from a grocery store. And I don't want to, I'm very careful to, you know, degrade any other kind of business or other process. But I will say when you're buying directly from a farmer, I think you're most likely going to have a good experience.
The thing is like any logical person can look at the process and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, you've figured out the tricks in the second trimester and so on and so forth. If you're buying directly from a farmer that's, you know, been fairly responsible, as opposed to buying from a grocery store where, use logic, like how many steps has this piece of beef gone through?
How many months has it been frozen?
It's literally going to change. And it's not that it's bad, you know, like you said.
Some people think about that.
But the thing is like that has to exist in the way that we're set up today, the way society's set up. Because not everybody can go buy directly from the farmer. Not right now. That capacity is not there. And there's probably a good chance that it's never going to be. You know, you guys probably have bigger dreams than that, but there's probably a good chance that that's never going to be. So that convenience factor and these big facilities that process all this to get it to the masses, that still has to exist. Mm-hmm. But there's just no way around it. Yeah. It's going to be totally different. You could apply that to anything. You could take any product that's custom made, that's custom manufactured. You know, let's take these Handlebend guys. You know these guys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But good friends. Yeah.
So the stuff that these guys are making compared to what you're going to go buy. You want to go buy a copper mug at Walmart?
Store. Yeah.
I mean, which one's going to be better? Obviously, this is going to be better. There's more care put in this. It's direct to you. You know, it's their hands on. I mean, you can apply this to anything. So that's pretty basic. I don't think there's any talking trash about any of the bigger systems, because the bigger systems do need to exist.
Absolutely.
But the fact is, the way that you guys do it, it's just better, man. I mean, there's...
and I think that's what you're saying is it's not an either or, it's an and. You should have the option to both. And I think that's the one thing is it's crazy. You look here just locally in Nebraska, how underserved the urban areas of Nebraska are with beef. We export a lot of our good stuff, you know. And I think that there's a space where, you know, it doesn't have to be either or. I think it's good for, though, like I said, I'm always an advocate. Obviously, I'm biased from buying directly from a consumer.
That's good.
A producer.
It's good to be.
Yeah, but there's a lot of benefit for producers and consumers alike. I think, one, you're seeing an ability for a producer to run their farm more like a business, so they're not dependent on a commodity market, which is why, going back to the distillery, that's a huge thing. I mean, we raise grain. We don't feed it all to our cattle. Mm-hmm. And so what are we going to do with that extra grain? Well, we're going to distill it into bourbon, and we're going to create a consistent price point for everything that we raise. So we do the same thing with the beef. That is a huge deal for us. And then we've also been able to help other farmers with their pork and honey to give them an outlet to market their products as well. From the consumer standpoint, I think it's extremely important as well, because it gives you the option to have high quality beef and you are supporting your local communities.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, can we hire Matt as the hype man for Common Folk Podcast? I mean, he had me sold on the elevators piece. Then he said bourbon, beef, and followed up with honey. I'm like, okay.
I'll be here all day, folks.
Yeah, let's do it. Come on now.
I know. I keep wanting to talk about this distillery too. Yeah, so
well, we'll get into that in just a second. But
I know, but like what he's saying is so interesting.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of really cool things going on.
I know.
On. That's why we talked about this earlier. This could be 4 hours, but
it's not
gonna be.
You were leading into something, Ben, and I kinda wanna get your guys' perspective on it because we talked about it on one of our earlier pods. Where it was, you know, fake meat versus real meat, uh-huh. just the difference.
Okay.
We actually had the Incrediburgers, you know, and the real
Whoppers. We tried all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Impossible Whoppers versus the, you know, just as a taste test. But I think you guys are kind of dialing back what I feel the ag community did to itself, and that is they didn't want to deal with things at every level. They wanted to just ship it off. Because they knew that packers are, you know, commodity companies wouldn't take advantage of them. No, they need us. We're the farmers. They need us. No, as soon as they got to the point to where they could flex, they did. And now, you know, and that whole story was try to hide the process, try to hide that, you know, that these things happen. And now you guys are being out in front, put it out on YouTube. No, we're going to have bad days. There's going to be ugly days. Cows die. To make beef, you know, and I think people are kind of growing up like, okay, yeah, we're ready to take the blinders off and figure this out.
Yeah.
Well, I think that it's interesting because to you know, as a society, we do have to, you know, I like what you're saying, Ben. We've got to have both because what we're doing at the end of the day is feeding people. And we have to have efficient processes in place to be able to get food to people mm-hmm. and make sure that, you know, but within those efficiencies and streamlining that process, you do lose the story. And mm-hmm. I think that's the one thing that is important for us, because if we don't tell our story, somebody else starts doing that for us. And that's where, in my mind, where the problem happens is because we're no longer being the ones to kind of control what our narrative is. And we kind of gave up the rights to be able to talk about it when those efficiencies came into place. Again, they're important and they're necessary, but we've got to have a way to be able to talk about what we do and how we do it and why we do it.
To that point too, something that I've always said, and it applies to the category that you guys are in as well, is convenience is that word convenience. That's where a lot of really good things start. Mm-hmm. And that's where they eventually turn into a problem. 100%. Like you can
absolutely.
Literally, like if you can keep that in your mind about anything that you run into, if you look at it, you're like, why are we doing it like this today? Because someone made it super convenient and this is mm-hmm. what it turned into and this is how we're doing it. And then people do things like you guys are doing and people think, oh my gosh, this is, you know, revolutionary and this is so cool. Look at this. This is how it was before convenience.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know
absolutely.
What I'm saying?
That's hard work. Doesn't that suck?
Yeah. And like I said, there's a level of food security that came from that process. There's a level of space where people
sure.
are you can purchase products for an affordable price. You
yep.
can go to
yep.
a space and buy a ribeye and have that experience for an affordable price. So there are benefits to it. But to your point too, where you said the egg industry, we shot ourselves in the foot by not wanting to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that 100%. I think that there's a space for us to be able to talk about the process and I think that there's going to be a lot of good benefits when you start to talk about the consumer producer relationship, and I think it might even alleviate to things that are bigger problems in our society down the road, where you're creating connection between rural and urban that are it's making people get out from behind their screen mm-hmm. and have a conversation with a producer and ask hard questions mm-hmm. about why do you do it this way, why is it done this way, and we can say, listen, these are the reasons why we do it this way, and then they can say, I don't like that. And we can say, well, that's great. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll try to change that because mm-hmm. you're my consumer. Mm-hmm. And I think the ag industry, the day they said, because when the first thing we learned in entrepreneurship school was every business, consumer first. You are consumer centric. The customer, they come first. Egg is the only place that we don't think like that, mm-hmm. where we say, well, people got to eat. They're going to eat the way I want to. And then you start mm-hmm. seeing things like the fake meat industry popping up. And you know, I actually commend the fake meat industry a lot. I think that they found a problem that we have created and they're meeting it. The thing is, it's interesting, is I think what somebody who's looking to buy fake meat is looking for and the way that a producer is producing, I don't think it's that far apart.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a space where mm-hmm. that if there was just a good conversation,
yeah.
and maybe that's the idealistic part of me, but if there was a good conversation, they'd see that they have a lot more in common than what they actually think. And,
I agree.
And there's a space where they'd say, oh, hey, I'm going to buy that beef then because then we have more relationships like that.
Yep.
So someone listening to this that really doesn't know about you guys, how, when you say you like tell your story or you want to be, I mean, how are they going to find you? Not where to find you, but so are you delivering meat, like to those that don't know, like straight to them? Do you have them come to your place and pick it up? Like, what is the process?
What's the mechanism?
Yeah, yeah. Like, how do you actually get to talk to this person then?
So our goal is to be able to buy meat from us in any way that is convenient for you. So okay. If you want to buy one cut of steak from us and we ship it across the country to you,
you can do that.
We'll do it.
Perfect.
You can go to our website, www.upstreamfarms.com, shameless plug right there, but and you can order there and we will ship it right to your home. But also through the pandemic, we found that there was a space where a lot of people, I think something primal kicked into people and they said the things they want, good quality protein, things like that, it kicked in and they wanted to fill a freezer.
And some security.
And some security, yes. Exactly.
When and they wanted to empty. Gather around a fireplace and cook a steak together with their neighbors, with their friends.
Absolutely.
Like a lot of that stuff, you're right, it came back to the forefront. Like, I miss my friends. I miss my people.
Yep. Yeah. What can we do? How can we create experience around that? We were able to meet that experience. And so through some innovative ways of getting our beef processed, because that was a huge thing.
Yeah,
we found some other processors that we worked with, which ultimately we have a really good relationship with a local processor in Lincoln who can do a higher quantity. We were able to meet that market demand. This is kind of full circle, because what you talked about at the beginning was you guys aren't as big as I thought you would be on social media and things like that. Well, we haven't actually spent the time on it, because our sales have grown, I would say, five times since and they've
how
grown
exciting.
To the point. Yes, and it's an awesome thing, but it actually got to the point where we're so busy with that the marketing, doing all the social media, it just didn't make as much sense. It was like, we're trying to do all these other things, and I honestly were seeing other word of mouth converting better than any social media post that we could create. Yep. As much as we tried to connect with consumers through a virtual space, telling a customer, hey, did you like our beef? Awesome. Tell your friends. That did way more than any post. And so I think us kind of thinking of it that way, we kind of got out of that space a little bit and stopped spending so much time there. But we were able to grow a lot during COVID, and it was a good space. So
I think with you guys and to touch on the social media thing, what I was getting at is that, again, we talked about that story, and you guys do have such a cool story to tell that people need to connect with, and you tell it in a really neat way. I mean, everything that I see that you guys do on social media, in my opinion, is second to none in a lot of people that I see. So that was my point, is that, like, that's there, and I don't see how it hasn't.
Thank you.
Top notch, like their whiskey.
I just don't see how it hasn't caught on more. But what I do know, based on the space that we've been in, is that eventually something's going to pop, and then it's going to go dumb. But, I mean, you got...
I got the mic now.
What do you got?
I was just saying, with Upstream Updates, is like the stories on Instagram, that kind of started when we came back to the farm. And so I grew up in the agricultural community. My dad's a vet, and so I grew up with, you know, livestock and everything, but I didn't grow up on a farming operation. And so I'd be driving down the road. I said, Joe, what the heck is this thing? And I'd describe it to him. And so I had lots to learn. And so Matt would always do Upstream Updates, or Joe would do some sometimes. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, I was learning just along with everybody else. And so I'd call Matt when he would talk about putting up hay or something like that. I said, go into more detail here, because you might get some questions here. And so it was a great opportunity. You had lots of conversations over Instagram or Facebook about people asking questions.
Right.
And so that was really cool to see people reaching out and asking for more clarification.
Well, what I like about what you guys are building is that I've always felt like the social media thing, excuse me, is not here for the long run. Like, in one form or another, it might be, but that's going to continue to change. So, you know, you build 200,000 followers on Instagram or whatever, great. You know, 2 years from now, that thing might not exist.
Yeah, you keep saying MySpace. I'm like, that's dead.
Yeah,
it's kind of gone down a little bit even now as we started doing the halves, holes, and quarters. You know, that's what we're into right now. And so, you know, we don't have as much time to be on Instagram or Facebook TikTok. We've been trying to do that, you know, a little bit. But just being a little bit more busy and supplying that demand that we've had over COVID has been changing that.
Yeah, and what my point is behind the scenes, behind social media, the business that you guys are building is sustainable, where I don't think social media really is sustainable, but it's a really cool way to tell your story.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think that's kind of what, going back to that storytelling thing, we do feel like it's not, and we need to get back on it. That just goes between working in your business and working on your business type of thing. Once we, you know, hire a few people to do some of the things that need to get done so we can do more marketing and tell our story better than what we've done in the last 18 months, we do feel like it's part of our responsibility as farmers to do that. Mm-hmm. Turn the camera back around on ourselves and say, hey, this is what we're doing and this is why we do it. It's not just about marketing, you know, marketing beef. It's about telling our story because that's what we should be doing as farmers in general.
But to play off of that, I think, you know, I was sitting there saying, I think I could make this really cool story about how, oh, we're so busy we can't be on social media. I do think that a part of that has been that the last 18 months have been very hard.
Sure.
And when something doesn't work out for you and, you know, you have livestock on the road 3 days in a row because you just can't find the hole in the fence that they're getting through, that's really hard to want to document, you know, because there's a level of embarrassment that comes with that through that learning curve. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we used to preach, oh, you got to be vulnerable on social media. You got to share your story. The reality of it is that's a lot harder to do.
Say at UNL, isn't it?
UNL, when you're sitting behind a desk, and saying, hey, guys, share your story, be vulnerable. And then you're getting your ass handed to you day after day. Eventually, you're like, I don't really want to share this. And so,
And if you put that out there and your neighbor sees that and he starts commenting, you know,
you're gonna get raked over the coals for sure. And I mean, and that's the thing is there's part of that that, you know, our local neighborhood is very, very supportive of us. We feel that support from them. It's more of it is a pride thing, but it's also, like Matt said, it's one of those things that you have to really learn how to be vulnerable. And we've had points where we have jumped on and said, hey, you know, this is what's going on our day. Yeah, I mean, kind of dipping into the distillery side of things, the first time that we got barrels in, and for those of you who don't know, we make bourbon. That's our predominant, what we're trying to go for. And that product has to age for a very long time before it gets into a bottle in your hand in a glass. Minimum for straight bourbon is 2 years. And so, you know, that product comes off the still as moonshine, you put it into a barrel and it ages. And that's where it gets its brown color and most of its flavor from. But the story is that when we get our barrels in, you know, we're going to put our first run. We got first put down our first run of bourbon, super excited. Got to this point where we're like super, you know, happy with what's coming off the still that we're ready to put it into a barrel. We get these barrels in, and of course, you know, they've been sitting there for a while we have been perfecting our distillation process. And we get ready to put our first product in that barrel, and I'm sitting there putting whiskey in the barrel. We're pumping it into the top of the barrel, and then all of a sudden there's just a little trickle of something coming out on the ground.
Stop.
And I go, I'm like, Matt's like, stop it. You're spilling stuff, Joe. You're spilling. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Like the hose is all the way down in the barrel. I don't know what you're talking about. And all of a sudden Matt just takes a cloth and wipes it away and it keeps coming. And we're like, oh my God. So it went from being the best day ever that we get to finally put our first product into a barrel and set it away to age for a long time. And all of a sudden this barrel's leaking. And because, you know, we didn't realize this, that those barrels are, we knew that these barrels are 100% charred on the inside. They go through this whole process that if you let them sit without anything inside of them, they're going to shrink and they're going to crack and there's going to be holes in them.
Oh, shit.
And so we quickly realized that we needed to find a way to get what we had pumped in there. Spent forever getting this product perfected. We really didn't want to waste it. So we sit there and we're like, we don't know how, you know, we'd have to reverse the pump and figure out how to get it through. And it was just like we were scrambling. And so Matt's like, we'll just siphon it. So
I just was thinking of that.
So, but if you can imagine it, all our barrel entry proof is at 110 proof. So you're taking 110 proof alcohol, sticking a hose in there, and then trying to suck it through a hose to get it to gravity fill back down into a bucket. Matt's gagging, spitting the stuff all over the place. We're just like trying to finally get to the point where we get it actually siphoned out. And it stops leaking, and we just sit down in defeat, and we're like, this sucks. This is a bad day. It was a great day. We had been documenting up to that point, and we're like, Matt's like, I don't know. He's like, should we take down these posts? Like, so people, and I'm like, no, Matt, we've got to tell people. We've got to tell people that this is what happened. And it was crazy because we did that, and the response we got was not, oh, you guys are idiots. Oh, right. You should have known better. It was, oh man, I'm just glad I'm not the only one that stuff like this happens to. Oh man, you guys are great. Yeah. You're, you know, and it's just crazy to hear that support even through those tough times.
So did you have the camera then, Emmy? Was that right?
I did not. I was waiting for the call after the first barrel was done, and I called Joe, and I said, so was it done? He goes, well, and he's telling me this story, and I'm like, you tried to siphon it? Like, what? And so, yeah, I looked forward to the documenting after that, because it was real, and it was honest.
But I can appreciate that you guys kept that up there, because there's There's a lot of blogs and vlogs and all sorts of other stuff that teach you how to like fix your dryer, fix your air conditioner, this or that. And we'll go to those because we try to fix our own stuff, right? You know, try to be self-sufficient. And you go through all these steps, and then you finally figure it out. You don't actually get the answer, but you go through all these steps, and then you don't go back and contribute because you figured it out. You got right there to where that mm-hmm. last comment was. Mm-hmm. And, like, we're trying to get better to, okay, now go back to that and say what you did to fix it, because this has happened, like, two or three times with that in the last couple of years where we fixed something, and the blog or the how-to, you know, conversation on whatever social media platform got us to that point, but we still had to figure it out.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And you could just tell they did, but then they didn't go back and tell the story.
Yeah, we definitely right. kind of just left it, but hopefully that helps somebody out, you know.
Oh, definitely.
You know, see the barrels. You know, we had them sitting there because we were prepared and we were ready to fill them, and then maybe we were a little too prepared because we didn't know that you had to rehydrate them. And so, yeah, it was nice to go back and explain
that. So what is the fix then? It was to get them wet on the inside?
Yeah, so, I mean, okay. Luckily you can rehydrate that barrel.
Oh, you can?
So, yeah,
okay.
You can. You just put a little bit of water in the, you have to set it up on top of, you know, those staves have to expand pretty much, and so expand back out, and the heads of the barrels have to. So you flip it over on its side so the barrel's sitting straight up and down. You put some water on the head. It'll reseal up. You put a little bit inside the barrel so that it's sitting on the inside of the head, and then you flip it, and it's a process that takes about 2 days to actually.
So that's what I was gonna say.
It's a long process. So it's another process. You know, unfortunately, to get a price break, we bought 16 barrels at a time, and we have this problem every time we go to fill a barrel now that we have to go through rehydration. It's got you know, rings on that barrel that you actually beat those rings down mm-hmm. to try to tighten everything up.
I don't know, Ben. They're Bourbon sounds a little watered down.
Yeah, no, we make sure that all of that gets out of there. I mean, no, and the kidding. Thing is that, you know, it's actually a process, you know, a lot of distilleries go through that, especially small distilleries. They go through those growing pains. But, you know, what we're doing is, you know, from a distilling standpoint, you know, it's there's not a lot of people that are doing it around us. Mm-hmm. You know, there's Nebraska probably has the lowest, I think probably one of the lowest amounts of distilleries per capita in the United States. And so, you know, you're kind of out on an island by yourself trying mm-hmm. to figure this whole thing out. And what distilleries are out there aren't necessarily willing to work with you because it is right. one of those things where it is a competitive thing. And, yeah. and so you do have to, there's not a lot of people that are willing to just reach out and say, hey, you know, we want sure. you to, there's not, you know, how many ever distilleries to figure.
It's not like a farming where you have a neighbor down the road that can help you with whatever you want. Yeah. They're just not around. So yeah. when you have problems, you can't just like
right.
call the neighbor and say, hey, how do you do this? How do you fix, yeah. how do you fix this? How do you fix that? You know, it's kind of just trial by error. Also being farmers, I think had some benefit to that too, because
sure.
we can
problem
rig
solved.
Things up a little bit, yeah. a little bit different, yeah. but it works.
So you guys are handy.
Oh, we try. I wouldn't say handy. I would say we are proficient. Yeah, innovative.
We're not like the handle bend guys.
Yeah. Oh, man, Mike and Matt, we've called them a couple times. There's a lot of copper in distillation, and they happen to have a lot of copper.
Yes,
so
they do.
Soldering and everything like that, they've helped us more than once.
Those guys are awesome.
We're trying to talk them into building us a new still. And
oh,
like,
nice.
We're going to stick with mugs for now. So.
Yeah. So you guys have talked about a lot of things, and there was one other thing I wanted to talk about on the beef side, and I definitely want to talk about the distilling, because I've had a couple people ask me this, and I don't know the answer to it, but you always hear about grass-fed and grain-fed mm-hmm. beef.
Yep.
Okay. So what you guys have going on, the way that I understand it, is raising them in the fields, you know, growing your own hays and forages and things like that, and then a grain finish and so on and so forth. That's the way that I understand it.
Yep,
and then
absolutely.
I've had people ask me, how does that actually work? And when someone says they finish the beef on grain, what does that mean? Like,
yeah.
do they sit there for 30 days and eat it, or you know what I mean? So
they
just
get
into that
final
just
meal.
For a minute.
Final meal, and it's just that's it. It's your last supper, and it's just a bunch of corn, and that's it.
I think there's a lot of people that are listening to this that don't know that, and you hear mm-hmm. that thrown around a lot because that's what it's become. It's like, well, that's marbled so nice because it's grain finished, you know, and mm-hmm. like people use all these things. So what's that all about?
So basically, I mean, what we say is it's what a lot of beef that's done in Nebraska. It's very typical. We're grass fed, grain finished, and that's basically is that the animal spends the majority of their life on grass pastures, in grass mm-hmm. pastures, eating grass, consuming forage. That is what's pretty natural to that animal's diet. The thing is you can get a higher quality product by supplementing grain into their diet. And you slowly do that over time. They're not just sitting there just gorging themselves on corn. Mm-hmm. They still get hay. They get a lot of hay. They get a lot of silage, which is a forage corn mix. And then they also get some grain corn on top of it. You can also feed things like flaxseed and millet and all different kinds of grains and distillers grains. And that's another byproduct distiller, mm-hmm. Of our distillery. Sure. So we're able to be kind of a closed loop system where mm-hmm. we feed all the distiller byproduct, which is what comes after distillation, the grain that's left over. We feed that to our animals too.
And it's healthier for the cattle.
Yeah. They're not getting drunk. Well, a lot of people think they are. We took all the alcohol away from it, but there is that side of it too. But basically, I think I can't really speak to the consumer perception of it as much, except for that I think a lot of consumers' perception of that space is that animal is in a confined lot, mm-hmm. doing nothing but eating and pooping mm-hmm. and dying, mm-hmm. and that's not the reality of it. The reality of it is that animal is getting a balanced ration and a balanced diet that we slowly convert into a higher concentration of grain. But up until the time that we process, they are always getting some sort of forage hay in their diet. And so from that standpoint, I believe that's what I was raised on. So my taste buds like that better. I've had grass-fed beef. I will never shame grass-fed beef. I don't enjoy it because that's not what I was raised on. So I think there's parts of – I've always tried it. I'm always willing to try something different. I remember we were just having this conversation on the way down. Emmy was in D.C. with some of her students, and she was like you know, some of. Oh yeah, you want to tell the story? Or she just tried a vegetarian burger, which whatever that means. You know, it's just a plant based burger.
Yeah.
And her students are like, your dad would be so disappointed in you because he's a veterinarian. And she's like, well, not necessarily. She's like, you know, I think it's always important to try different things. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not necessarily saying that one's better than the other. I'm just saying I think what there should be. It's not an and or. It's an and, not a either
an or.
Sure. Exactly. It's an and world. It's not an or world, right?
Yep.
It can be and.
It can be both. Yep. And so I think there's another side is the health side of grain, grass finished beef 100%, you know, which is that there's higher omega-3s. And there is some truth to that in that beef. That's healthier for you. It's per ounce of fat, there's more omega-3s, but there's more marbling and intermuscular fat, and that's one thing. I'm huge on this. I'm not a dietitian or anything like that, but fat is not bad for you.
No, not
you know,
at all.
You know, processed food and sugar and things like that has changed in our diet more so than just fat in general. Fat is good for you. And so per ounce of fat, there's the same amount of omega-3. Well, there's not per ounce of fat, excuse me, but there's more ounces of fat in a grain-finished beef. So you're actually, when you're eating a 18-ounce steak of, let's say, grain-finished beef versus 18-ounce steak of grass-finished beef, you're going to get the same amount of omega-3s and the same amount of vitamins and things like that in mm-hmm. that beef, mm-hmm. At least from where my standpoint is. You know, now I'm always open to learning more. I'm always an open book. But that's how we do it. That's our process right now. It's worked out pretty well for us so far. And the other thing is really big, and I think that we get a little too politicized on the fact that I think farmers can always be doing more for our planet, doing mm-hmm. a lot more to make ourselves more environmentally friendly. We do a lot with rotational grazing. We do cover crops. We put armor on the soil. We do no-till farming practices. Those are big things that help offset our animals' emissions. Our animals have emissions. That's something that they do.
Sure.
Humans do. We're the most, humans are the most unnatural thing to the planet. You know, and so whatever we can do to be offsetting the things that we do that are unnatural to the planet, we should be trying to do, in my opinion. And so we do all of those things in order to just try to not only do what's best for our animal, not what's only best for our consumer, but what's best for our planet as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something everybody can agree on. So, you know.
So just kind of rewinding back to the start there, you talked about vegetarian burger.
Yeah.
I feel like every burger I've ever had is that because that's all cattle eat or plants.
Oh, exactly. That's your food, right?
Yeah. Oh, I never thought about it like that.
I mean, that's not what you're talking about?
No, you're right.
I think that, you know, the biggest thing what Matt's saying is that we – when you talk about being politicized is that, you know – and I think it goes back to that and or the or statement. Mm-hmm. You know, if tomorrow – we were told that the best thing for our consumers that, you know, I don't want to be sitting here. I mean, you look at like the tobacco industry, you know, they can't sit there and say that smoking a cigarette you know, pack of cigarettes a day is good for you. You can't say that. And, you know, so if they came out tomorrow,
yes, I can.
They can say that, but should they? And you know, that's the thing is, as farmers, we have to be responsible. That's what being a responsible farmer is, listening to the science, listening to what – it's not out there for us to just disagree. And, you know, I think there's that whole idea that, you know, oh, just because I read on the internet means it's fake. You know, there is science backing some of the things that we're talking about. And so we've got to listen to that. We've got to be really intentional about making sure that the management decisions that we're making are good for our planet, good for our consumers, and even sometimes if it doesn't align with what we want in our pocketbooks, we have to make sure that, you know, cover crops doesn't make us a lot of money. It's not like it's making us a hand over fist, but we're doing it because it's important, and it's what we need to do as farmers to change how we've done things in the past. And if we can continue to do those things, I think we're going to be better off as an industry.
Well, and those type of things open the door for smaller operations like you guys. I'm scared as hell with like what Bill Gates is doing right now, just buying up gobs and just tracts and tracts of land. There's rumors that China's buying farmland in America. Yeah. Like, that scares the hell out of me. And a long time ago, my father and I had this conversation. Like, if these small guys don't get with it and figure out how to pull this off, it's going to go away. And then you're going to lose it all to, like, what's already been happening, where the packers have all this power over, you know, you guys raising the cattle. And it's just ass backwards from the way it should be. But once again, I feel like us farmers, us ranchers, we've kind of done it to ourselves. Out of convenience.
Mm-hmm. Adapt or die.
Yeah, exactly. Figure it out. You know, whether that's through sharing the story or diversifying into a distillery, which I think that's a top-notch idea.
It is.
We're working at it.
I had a question, though, but how long has your family had the farm? I don't know if we talked about that.
So,
like, operational.
We're younger farm than most. Okay. Not all farms. I've seen a lot of young, really young farms out there. We'd be considered fourth generation. Our great grandpa, like in terms of the farming side of things, on our dad's side, he got here from Switzerland in 1920. And I believe he left Switzerland because he wanted to go to college and his dad wouldn't let him. So that was, he was a rebel and he
really?
Took off. Yep. And it's kind of a cool story. He saved, he only wrote to his girlfriend at the time and he sent her a ticket when he had gotten enough. He'd worked for a farmer, didn't speak English, worked for a farmer here in Northeast Nebraska. And then he got enough saved up. They sent a ticket for his girlfriend. They got married in Iowa. He met her in a train station in Iowa. They got married there because that was like you get a marriage license without having to wait a week or something like that. So they could get married right there. And so they got married, moved to Nebraska, started farming. And then my grandpa and his brother farmed. My dad and his brothers farmed. And now we're farming. Okay. And so, like I said, there are much older farms than that. Though,
well, yeah,
we'd be considered fourth generation farmers.
You want to talk about entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, that right there.
Yeah.
I don't like what's going on here. I'm going to America and I'm going to follow.
Bye-bye, Switzerland.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. Talk about putting yourself out there, you know?
It's crazy what some of, you know, you listen to farming stories like that, and it is very inspiring to, like, think that, you know, that's kind of what we're trying to do with the distillery a little bit. Because, you know, we had the luxury of having four generations before us know how to raise good beef. We're still learning, like we're still changing our practices, but we had that product was ready to go to market from the day one. You know, with the distillery, we feel like we're pioneering that. We're adding, that's our little bit of a stamp, you know, right, we're taking this beef directly to consumer. That's not what our family's done in the past. But with the distillery, this is a new product that's coming to our family that's completely different. And we have a lot of pride in that. And we know that when we get down on ourselves, you know, things aren't going our way in the distillery. Remember that story of our great grandpa coming here being like, you know, he had to go through four generations to actually create.
He had to learn
beef.
How to speak a foreign language.
Exactly.
While he was on the job.
If he can do that, we can create good spirits. Yep. So.
Yep. Yeah. No, you guys have gone through some of the same things in different ways.
Yeah. And our grandpa on our mom's side also owned the grocery store in town. So he was kind of entrepreneurial in that way. He just bought the grocery store and did that for his whole life. So it's kind of fun because we say, well, we're kind of in groceries. I mean, we're not. It's a certain type of groceries, but we're still in groceries. So I was like, you know, try a nod to both sides of our family.
So is that coming, or is that a vision that you guys have? Like, if I travel to Albion, Nebraska, is there going to be an upstream where I can go there, buy some steaks, buy some bourbon? You know, is that something you guys have thought about?
Yeah, I mean, we would love to have a physical location.
Some eggs.
Some eggs. Oh, absolutely. Produce. Just have a whole, the whole farm to table experience. And I think that there's a space for that. And I think we'd really like to do that. Our whole thing is we'd like to survive from a distribution standpoint where we are able to. It's really, you know, it's kind of backwards from what a lot of, especially in the distilling side. You see a lot of distilleries, they will create, or even the brewing industry. The brewing industry had, they started, you know, they usually start a tap house of some kind, and then they'll distribute slowly over time after they get a brand built. Well, since we've already built this brand around the beef and our farm, we feel like we've got a certain amount of leverage where we can go distribution right away and kind of wait to do that experience. Now, we'd love to create an in-person experience where we can do a cocktail lounge of some kind coupled with a market where we can do – there's something very similar to that.
Or a restaurant,
and there's something very similar up to that in Norfolk, Nebraska. Joe and I look at it. Albers, the feedlot. They have a place called I'm not going to remember the name. It's really cool.
I know what you guys are talking about.
It's very cool. I think that experience to me, when Joe and I saw that, very inspiring for us. We're like, this is so cool to see. And Handlebend, you know, those guys have been incredible. What they're doing for their community, I think that there's a huge space for that to happen in our foreseeable future.
I think that brick and mortar idea is important to have that physical location. I mean, you guys know that with your business. It's nice to, you know, we do have, I mean, we have a brick and mortar distillery, but it's just for, you know, producing and we've got our freezer there and everything like that with beef. But I mean, it's literally just for production only. It's not for somebody to walk in and actually have the experience that we want them to have. We can give you a tour, but that's the extent that we can do. And so, at some point there in Albion, Nebraska, we would love to have a brick and mortar location where you can come and have the entire experience that we want you to have and understand our farm from that standpoint. So
the brick and mortar thing is definitely coming back around.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
people want the experience. That's right. Like we've been talking about from the top of this.
The story, the experience. Meet the people.
We had a long – so Handlebend, it's funny you bring them up. They're not just friends of ours. They're mentors for Matt and I. We sought them out. They sought us out. And they have been huge business mentors because for us. And if you don't know Matt and Mike, they remind us a lot of Matt and I. They're just really really – they give their advice without you having to pay for it, right? They're just extremely generous. You know, we went and had a conversation with them a week ago just about this exact same thing, about how, you know, I think we were up there fixing, we had to take an irrigation motor or something up there to get fixed or something, and we said, they were like, hey, we just text them, we're in town. They dropped everything that they were doing just to come chat with us because they care about what we're doing as a business and vice versa. But they are, if you don't know, you know, the Handlebend building that they just built up there is very brick and mortar. And, you know, we were having this exact conversation with them that they're like, it's important for your community to have that space of gathering and having that opportunity to for your community to rally around what you're doing. You know, honestly, what they have done has allowed us to believe that it's possible to do that in our hometown and for it to be successful. And because they're doing that, I think it's made us realize that, hey, this is maybe our next step down the road to being able to provide that experience for our customers.
I was telling Ben, last podcast we recorded, like, I wanted to go to location on see you guys' farm, so we'll have to go and then visit them too.
Oh yeah, you're always welcome for a tour, and that's a good point too, is because they're also, I think they're a little bit like, put this up because it'll give people stuff to do. I think they foresee people driving up from the more urban areas. And they would love to have a jumping off point for all of these. I mean, gosh, if you're listening to this and you're from even outside of Nebraska, you know,
most of the listeners are from outside
of Nebraska. If you're driving through Nebraska, get off the interstate. There are vibrant communities that are doing really cool things. There's a coffee shop, Normal Roasting, another business mentors for us and just good friends. And they're doing this. It looks like you took a roastery and a coffee shop out of the middle of downtown New York City and you plopped it in the middle of Burwell, Nebraska.
Wow.
I mean, it is beautiful what they've done. And people love it, you know. They support it, and it's incredible because they're able to get they ship. They also ship. they ship their stuff all over the country, their beans and the, everything that they roast. But they also have a spot where, a farmer, you walk in there, and it's kind of funny because there's like a 75-year-old farmer sitting there enjoying a coffee. And usually you'd think of some, hipster. having their drip coffee or something like that.
Pretty Gucci.
Yeah, it's Gucci, pretty cool. Yeah. But it's a really, they've provided this experience where people are willing to support them. So like I said, if there's anything you take away from this podcast, if we've rambled on way too long, if there's one thing that you can just take this bite and put at the beginning, if you're not from Nebraska, get off the interstate, because there is a lot. Get off the interstate. There's a lot to see.
Get off the interstate.
Yeah, I like that. Is that the
name, the title of it?
Maybe it'll be.
Get off the interstate.
It's definitely a new t-shirt. Get off the interstate. Yeah. That's great.
That's true, yeah. On the distillery side of things, just to kind of have a little bit more of a conversation around that, so you guys are doing, is it just bourbon right now, or how's that going?
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize, how long that takes, that process takes. And so, we're mainly cranking out bourbon right now, and we have the luxury to do that. In the distilling industry, you don't have that luxury. You've got to have some sort of clear spirit that's ready to go in a bottle right after.
And that's kind of what I was getting at, because it seems like every time I hear a new one pop up, the vodka's hitting the streets. Yep.
But why is that?
Because there's no aging requirement. There's no aging time.
It's super fast.
It's super quick. It comes off the still. You cut it down whatever proof you want with water, and it goes in the bottle and you sell it. But that's the unfortunate part. It's not as high quality of a product, so therefore you can't – it doesn't – it's kind of you could lose money on that product really quick, because the amount that it takes you to make that product versus what you can actually get for it versus bourbon or something that's been aged is so much less, because that market is so saturated right now. Everybody, you can make a vodka right away. But the problem with that is that you're just another distillery creating vodka. There's nothing unique about that. By definition, vodka is a clearless, odorless, tasteless product. You're not really supposed to be able to distinguish that from any other product. By the definition of the federal government, you're really not supposed to be able to.
And I've had a little bit of an inkling about that. I've never really dug into it myself, but that's what I've kind of always thought, and the little things that I've heard. And it's so funny to me, because I'm always watching these like celebrities coming out with their own vodka and stuff like that. And I'm thinking to myself, come on, guys. You're definitely fooling somebody, but you're not fooling me.
Well, and that's the thing is that's the deal is you can crank out vodka like crazy. And like Joe said, margin's tighter. Your cash flow is going to be a little harder, but you can cash flow while you're waiting for your aged stuff to get ready, while you're waiting for your bourbon to get and your whiskey just to be, to give it the time it needs. And a lot of distilling, whether you're going to make it or not depends on can you survive that time before your first bourbon is ready. And a lot of people, there's a way to do, for a while, this was something we're kind of against doing, is you can also source barrels of bourbon that's already been aged from other companies called like MGP, right? Mm-hmm. And you can have, you'll have your bourbon, but you'll also have, somebody else's bourbon basically that you're selling under your label. It's white label bourbon that you're buying in.
Yeah.
And then you're selling that just to kind of get your brand out there, get some recognition. We talked about for a while, we'd do, from our farm and from the neighbors, right? Like you'd have something that it's not your bourbon, but you're able to sell it and create cash flow while you're waiting for your bourbon to get ready. We're kind of against that because we don't, like Joe said, it is a luxury that we have, but because we built this beef business, because we're farmers, we can cash flow our distillery with these other sides of our business. And so that's allowed us to take the time to let our bourbon age, and take the time we need before we're gonna kick it out. And honestly, if you ask us to tomorrow, when's it gonna be ready? And oh my gosh. If I had a nickel for every time we've been asked that. And honestly, we say it's ready when it's ready, because we'll try it. Yeah. Right now we have something in a bottle that's really like. It's 2 years old, and we're thinking maybe this fall we might kick it out. But we might get a wild hair and say, let's let it sit for another year.
Yeah.
And I think that the nice part about that is we can take the time that we need to let it do that without having to. Now, we've had to really be strategic about blocking out all the other noise. It's saying, get it out. We want to know. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. But we want to take the time, because we've built quality around the beef company. We're not going to do anything different when it comes to our bourbon and our whiskey.
That's a good move.
Whoa. Are you saying diversification helps a business?
It's crazy. Which is kind of counterintuitive to like the idea that we're not going to push out vodka, because really, having more products is really going to, it's going to help you out. One of the other big misconceptions in the distilling industry with vodka is that
people are assuming that every distillery can make their own vodka, and a large chunk can't, us included. We actually can't make our own vodka. You have to have the right distillation equipment to do it. If you walk into a distillery and you see like the old style pot still that you're sitting there seeing, that like you see on moonshiners and stuff like that, you will not be able to achieve the proof by federal government, which is 190 proof, to be considered vodka. Most distilleries actually buy in ethanol from a small ethanol plant that's called Grain Neutral Spirits, GNS, and they will either, if it's good enough, they'll just put it into a bottle, cut it down with water, put it in a bottle and say, here's the product, and put their label on it and say, this is our product and this is our premium vodka or whatever it is. And some people will run it through the still one more time and clean it up or whatever they want to do and say that, you know, this is our premium vodka. And so that's, you know, it's crazy to me because people are trying to set themselves aside with this product that is, that doesn't have any character to it. It doesn't, and it doesn't really align with what we want to do, because that's why bourbon is so fun for us and so cool, because it represents us as a brand. It's got character. It's got a story to it. It's the only thing. You won't get another barrel of bourbon that's going to taste like anything else in the world that doesn't taste, that, that comes from our farm.
And that's kind of what we started this conversation with, is that it's the story behind it. Like anybody can go out and do those things that you just said and create a brand and market and, and try to move as much as they can and so on and so forth, but it doesn't have that story. And what does that story mean, and what's it worth?
Yeah, and get on Instagram, show some TNA vodka.
And to go off what Joe was saying is to take it one step farther is, you know, you, in the maturation process where the barrel is aging and the whiskey is going throughout those staves, it goes through contractions and expansions when it comes with the temperature changes and things like that. One, this is my plug. Why Nebraska, I think, is a perfect place to make a lot more bourbon. And I see
preach,
that.
Brother.
Let's go. You know, I we have very diverse temperatures, very diverse barometric pressures. I think it's perfect. Why not Nebraska? We're right, you know, we're right in the middle of corn country. This is the perfect place to make bourbon. And I think people are catching on to that. I think we'll see a lot more distilleries in the coming years pop up in Nebraska, because I think it's perfect for our state. But another thing about it is I think that what's unique to us is that you could take our barrels where we age them at in our Rick House, and you could take them and put them even in Omaha. You could take them down to Oklahoma. You could take them all up to North Dakota. The products can taste different afterwards because of the way that it ages, and so of where it ages. And so we think it's really cool that you can, our process, and you'll see a lot of distillers be very transparent about the grains they're using, their mash bills and everything like that, because they know the where we age it, where it counts, you're not going to be able to replicate that. And so for us to be able to age it where we age it, and then on the flip side, the grain that is in that barrel was grown 200 yards behind our distillery.
It's yours.
You can't replicate that. So we're an open book. You know, we say, like, if you come in, see what we're doing. Like, we have no secrets, because try to replicate that process.
So you almost need like a, like whatever year it was barreled, that you've got a story about, like, what was the weather over
that's
those
what
next
I was
2 years.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that's kind of what we want to do is, like, saying, you know, hey, this has gone through, you know, the high during this year was we were up at, you know, above 100 degrees, and the low was negative 20, which honestly, that happened to us. These barrels that we're aging right now have gone through that in their life. They have gone through that. And it's a cool thing to be able to say, you know, Nebraska bourbon. Everybody talks about the bourbon state, which is obviously in Kentucky. And, you know, I went down to distillation school down there, and people look at you and they say, you're from Nebraska? Like, what are you doing down here? Like, what do you actually think that you got to run? I mean, we've had, you know, people that we've talked to about, you know, questions we've had in the distilling industry, and they're like, you're not going to make that work in Nebraska. You know, we're in Nebraska, like, they're like, well, how far away are you from Omaha? And we're like, well, 2.5 hours. And like, guys, how are you going to make this work? And we're like, you don't understand Nebraskans. You don't understand the pride that we have and where we grew up and why people care about the products that are made here. And if more people, you know, that's why we're so focused on quality, because we don't want to give Nebraska bourbon a bad name. You know, we could have pushed this out a year ago, and we would have probably sold it all and made great money doing it. But we're not going to do that. We are going to make sure that this stuff is quality, and that it gives Kentucky a run for their money, because we believe that we can create products just as good, if not better, than what they're doing it. And that's how we see ourselves from a distillery standpoint. We don't see ourselves as another Nebraska distillery. We consider ourselves as a collective of distillers that are going to be able to make quality bourbon and quality products that line and pair really well with our beef and kind of what we want to try to do. So, I mean, it is crazy to me that, you know, we get a lot of questions about that process, and we're out here just trying to be an open book and answer as many questions as we can.
And with that being said, we talk a huge game. because we want to be perfect and we want to do everything perfectly. But we are still 26-year-olds who are young entrepreneurs who are still learning. And I think the whole thing with that is that we are still going to make mistakes. And I think that it's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be smooth sailing. And I don't think anybody's going to go through that process with smooth sailing.
Yeah. For sure.
And so I think that being transparent on this is where we want to go. I mean, I agree 110% with Joe. We plan to give Kentucky a run for their money. And we believe that Nebraska will someday in terms of the bourbon industry. Mm-hmm. And I think in the beef industry, I think there's going to be a space where we're going to do amazing things as a state. And I think we can be a common ground in the middle of a very undivided country right now. And I really think, believe that in this state. With that being said, we got a long way to go. And like I said, we're 26-year-olds. We got a lot to learn, a lot to do. But I think building, being on this podcast, talking with people like the guys from Handlebend and getting more people in this space, I think that we're going to do some really cool things down the road. So
back to the weather. God, I just love that. Thinking that your bourbon could be different each year, but just tweaked a tiny bit because of the weather. I don't know enough about bourbon, being honest. He's more the hard liquor
guy. I don't know a whole lot about it.
Well, I mean, you drink more hard liquor than I do. Yeah, like the White Claws. So White Claw beer is where I'm at. But
the cool part about bourbon too, I mean, and just getting more of the technical side of it, that you have that it takes to make a barrel, one oak tree will, on average, make 1.5 barrels. And every oak tree is going to have different characteristics in the next, depending on how old it is, where it comes from in the state, what it's gone through in its lifetime is going to bring out different flavors during that maturation process. And so you could have two barrels that are not one barrel is alike. You could have two barrels sitting next to each other, and they could be half brother and sister, but they're not the same. Sure. They didn't come from that same oak tree.
Well, even from the barrel.
That's where the term single barrel comes from is, you know, that product will probably not be replicated. Most distilleries, what they're doing, and like you talk about like big distilleries down in Kentucky, a lot of them, what they're doing is they're blending hundreds of barrels together to get a specific flavor profile that's very consistent. With what we're going to be doing is we don't have enough barrels right now aging to be able to have that luxury to have a consistent product. So everything that we push out is going to be single barrel.
Yeah.
Every barrel will probably taste a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And that can be a detriment, but it also can be huge.
Oh, you're embracing the differences. Yes. You know, you're embracing the story. Yeah, I'm buying into it.
I mean, and that's cool. That's agriculture, right? There's ebbs and flows, and it's up and down all the time. And that's the cool part about bourbon. I mean, it's not all the same. You got so much differentiation between those products.
For sure.
And I think going back to, you know, who drinks the hard liquor and who drinks the White Claws, when we have a space, we're going to do some Women Whiskey Wednesdays to get people out to the distillery and say, you know, however you want to drink your whiskey is the best way. Whether you want it neat, whether you want it with ice cubes, whether you want it with two flicks of water, whether you want, you know, whether you want some Coke in there, you know, it's whatever you like. And so to have a safe place, especially for women, to come out and experience that and say, okay, what do I want to try in there? What do I want to do? I think that'd be really cool. You know, it's a masculine, manly thing to drink whiskey.
I really but like is these it? People, Ben.
Right.
Yeah, whiskey, women. I mean, I'm all about it.
No man allowed. No, this is a safe place for everybody. Like, for just to come and try it. Yeah. And just you don't have to like it. That's okay. But just give a space to, you know, you walk up to the bar and you're like, oh, whiskey water, which personally I like, but not a lot of people do. And that's okay to come out and try it out. So maybe the women meet on Wednesdays and you guys can deal with the men on Thursdays or something like that.
Yeah, the brutes.
Yeah. I like that, yeah.
The bourbon thing, just so people can have a full understanding of that, because there's specifics that make it bourbon. And like you talked about, a couple years in the barrel, what are the other specifics in order to call it that?
Yeah, so all bourbon is whiskey, but not all whiskey is bourbon. And so whiskey is the overarching term for a spirit that has been aged from grain. But bourbon is unique to not Kentucky. That's a misconception. It's unique to the United States. So it has to be first and foremost distilled in the United States and barreled and aged in the United States. It's got to be a product of that. It's got to be a product of at least 51% corn, which is great because we grow a lot of corn in this state. Mm-hmm. And our mash bill has 80% corn in it. It has to be distilled under 160 proof. And again, that's a distilling terminology that just pretty much means the proof that's coming off the still has to be under 160 proof. It has to be barreled under 125 proof. So when once after it's been off this come off the still, we have to cut it down with water under down to at least 125 proof to be and that's actually all of these things are regulated by the federal government. And then it also cannot be bottled under 80 proof. And so over 80 proof, barreled under 125 proof, distilled under 160 proof. And then for straight bourbon, there's a big difference if you look at your label and your bottle and stuff like that. The only difference between, unless it has an age statement on it, between bourbon and straight bourbon is that straight bourbon has to have at least a minimum of 2 years of age on it.
So that is a lot of rules to follow.
It's a lot of rules.
Wow.
And it was kind of mind-boggling for us when we first started. But it also gave you a lot of a template too. You learned a lot of like this is how, like it was already those rules that were created to protect the quality of bourbon allowed you to already have are your framework of how you're going to start, and then you can kind of play with some things. Like one thing that's going to set us aside a little bit is a lot of distilleries will have a high barrel entry proof, and then they'll go right up to that 125. And then they'll add all their water in on the back end because they don't want to store water. It costs you money to store water. Sure. You want to put as much whiskey in that barrel, put it on the shelf because it costs you money to do that, and then you cut it all down at the end. For us, we see that there's value, and from what we've learned from some mentors of ours, in adding more water in the beginning when you're cutting it down to that 125 and going in at a lower barrel entry proof, because it gets time for that water to go through that maturation process. It actually increases the maturation process when you have more water in the barrel. Huh. And so it allows that process to happen. It allows that marriage for water and whiskey to happen. And then we'll add like a little bit, you know, then after that, that's where the craft is. It's saying, okay, we're going to try our whiskey at different proofs. And we're going to decide what proof do we want to put it in the bottle. You know, you have to be under a certain proof, but how do we want our customer to experience it? You know, so when you set a glass down and you put whiskey neat in there and you sip it, you are tasting that exactly how that master distiller wanted you to taste it. If you don't like it, that's great, because then you can add in a little bit of water and you can open it up, or you can and get different flavors that come from it, or you can drop some ice in there, and as that ice melts, then it'll dilute that product, and it'll take off some of the harshness of that product, and then that allows you to experience that whiskey in a different way. And if you really hate it, you can add Coke into it. But I just going back to what Emmy was saying is, I think that whiskey has been branded very much towards a specific audience, and I think that there's a space. It was so funny watching. We got into bourbon, and this is a little anecdotal story of when Joe and Emmy started dating. I think you guys used to like. I would pop in on their dates, which was super cool for your brother to
the
be
third
like,
wheel,
just to be like, what are you guys doing? And they're like, we're on a date. Oh, sorry. But anyways, they would buy a different bottle of whiskey and they would just try it together. And that was, I think that's how you guys really started to like that product you guys developed together. I'll let Emmy tell the story.
Yeah, we just got into buying two bottles at the time, and then so we could compare the notes of back to forth. You know, I grew up, my dad was a big whiskey drinker, and so I got to try a little bit with him, and then with Joe in the business, I'm like, okay, this is business. We have to really figure this out. And so we'd get two, and then we'd try to, you know, we'd first taste, and then it kind of went downhill after that, after you taste tested too many. But that was our date nights. We know we'd get two new ones, and then we'd figure out what we liked and what we didn't, and we went from there. So it was really cool.
There you go.
But to get back to what makes bourbon, it's a completely unique process to itself. It can't be replicated. You cannot do it unless it follows those same guidelines, and it's huge. It's a lot to take in, but like Matt said, it's a good template, and we kind of figured out what we liked and what we wanted from those date nights. We figured out what we liked. We researched, did our research on what the mash bill was, how long was that aged, what was that product like, and from there we were able to create our own product based off of what we were tasting and what we really liked. So
it's pretty cool.
Yeah, whiskey brought you guys together, not
not pulling apart.
That's the thing,
success story right there.
Yeah, I think that's you know, part of it. You've got to look at, you know, the product is it can be really bad for some people, and for us, you know, like I said, you've got to do it responsibly. You've got to drink it responsibly. Mm-hmm. I think there's that stigma around hard alcohol, especially in the state of Nebraska. We can fund breweries all day long, which they have their own hurdles. But if you think that the breweries have hurdles, the distilling industry has twice as much of what the stigma around hard liquor is. And if we can learn how to, you know, put ourselves in a better light by, you know, sharing our story and why we produce mm-hmm. what we produce, I think that we can break down some of that red tape a little bit.
Maybe promote, you know, personal responsibility too. I don't know.
We had
it's upstream's fault.
I'm kidding. Yeah.
And now we take a shot.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
We had Millennial Farmer Zach here. And Randy, Master Pipe Layer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it reminded me what you guys were talking about, where you said, like, you got to know each other well over whiskey as opposed to, like, fighting or whatever. Because what did Randy say? It was, like, water. This is a farmer thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What did he say?
Yeah, water's for fighting, whiskey's for drinking.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, whiskey's drinking, water's fighting, yeah. Yeah. And in the farm world, that's the thing. It's like the water rights. Everyone's fighting over this, this kind of thing. But whiskey, man, let's hang out and have a drink.
I mean, there's that old saying that, like, when you have a bottle that's special or something like that and you're with family and friends, you don't put the cork back on that bottle because those are the people that you're supposed to enjoy that with, you know, there's friends and family. And so, you know, that's kind of one of our things. It's very romanticized, and it is romantic. It's a romantic industry to be in. If you look at the history of the bourbon industry, you know, Emmy and I figured that out. It's a very romantic product. It's something that you know, generations have put so much effort in to make that mm-hmm. product. And, you know, we want to be the first generation in our family to be able to do that. But if you look at a lot of the distilleries and the history of it, you know, some of those barrels that are coming out of those distilleries, the people that made them never got to taste them because they've been aging that long. Mm-hmm. And that's such an insane story. I mean, there's 20-year-old bourbons that are out there that, you know, not that...
A great-great-grandfather is the one that put it in there.
Yes.
You know, and his great-great-great-great-grandkids are going to get to enjoy it.
That's such a cool – I mean, so just a little story. Our great-grandpa, he made wine. He would make it in his basement. And it was like during – there was a time during Prohibition where you were legalized that you could make your own wine if mm-hmm. you wanted to. So he grew grapes and made wine. Grapes are tough to grow in Nebraska, but he mm-hmm. did it. And it was I don't know. I never got to try it. But that is something that I think about in my head is someday – when we moved into that old farmhouse, there was a little cellar down there that had empty bottles in it.
Oh.
And Joe and I were like, if only they had a little bit of wine in
them.
Yes. I would just, yeah, exactly. That was an idea at one point. It was an idea. We were like, that's not the right way to sell alcohol. But for a while, I was like, man, we could just flip the red light on and people knew, like, this is the house you hit. But we decided not to do that. But I was like, man, someday my great-grandkids will be able to they'll be able to try something that we created, and for me to have that experience, I really yearn for that. So I'm really excited to be able to create that for you know, my great grandkids down the road or anything. And in fact, our first barrel that we made, you know, I said it's in the fall should be ready, but that's actually the second barrel we made. The first one is going in the basement, and we will never open it. And I don't think it's ever gonna sit there. It's gonna sit, and I anticipate we'll never bottle it. Hopefully someday somebody down the road will, but it won't be us.
Well, you talked about, I mean, grandkids, so then. Do you have a significant
other? I have a girlfriend, but I'm still working on the whole marriage thing.
Okay,
so
we're
it's in the
just had
it's
to
in
ask.
The works.
Don't rush in, buddy.
No.
So to that last point there, you know, like you said, your great grandkids will get to have something that you've created. You know, you guys as great grandkids really are getting to have something that your family created through the beef and the genetics and the family, and you're able to share that with so many people like us. So really, you know, it's kind of the same type of thing, really, when you think about it.
I mean, that's how we look at it, and that's how we viewed this. That's why vodka just doesn't make sense to us.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be bourbon for us, because that product for us is just it realigns with our values. It aligns with who we are, how we were brought up, and it's going to take time. I think that's the thing is, you know, we get. People almost are like, are you guys even doing anything in that distillery? Are you guys actually doing it? Like, there's no product coming out of there. And what people don't understand is, you know, no one wants that product to come out as soon as we do, but we are not going to push it out because it represents who we are. So until it's perfect, until we deem it that we we feel like it gets our stamp of approval on it, then we'll feel comfortable when people come in and say, oh, that's crap, it's not good, you know.
Sure.
It doesn't matter because we think it's good. Yeah. And we love it, you know. And we've gotten that with the beef sometimes. People say, hey, you know, oh, this wasn't this.
Really?
I mean, there's people out there. They crazy. Put their nose in the air and it doesn't. I don't think there'd be any cut of beef was good for them. But when we get those, it brushes right off our shoulder because we know that what we're doing and our process and how it was created, it means something. It means something to us. And so that's, to us, where our bourbon's going to be at. It's not coming out until it's perfect.
And at that point, you don't have anything to second guess. So if someone doesn't like it, hey, it's cool, man. We did everything that we wanted to do. It's not for everyone. You know, if you like it, you do. If you don't, you don't.
It's a product you can stand behind. Yep. And I think that's a big thing. And what you just had mentioned too, Ben, about, you know, our family having generations that were being farmers that were growing great beef and learning how to grow great beef. From our standpoint, I can't do the table thing. But from our standpoint, I think that we see in the distillery that being farmers has a big, I guess, impact on the quality as well. And sure. So when you see the bottle, you know, whenever that bottle hits the shelf, we already know what the label looks like. We've been working with this graphic designer she's incredible, great, very, very talented. And we shared our vision with her, and she has knocked it out of the park in terms of, we said, we want to be known as farmers, not distillers. Mm-hmm. We want to be known not as distillers who happen to farm. Mm-hmm. We want to be known as farmers mm-hmm. who have a distillery, and that distillery is on our farm because it is important for our farm to survive.
Cool.
And so that is going to be a part of the entire brand, the label, everything like that, because we want to be able to share that experience, and we want people to, not even knowing us, look at the bottle and say, this was made by farmers.
Yeah.
This wasn't made by distillers who, you know, inherited some ground back west and they, you know, they happen to have some corn that they throw into it. We are the ones that are raising the grain, we're planting it, and we're caring for it all the way up until the point that it gets harvested and put in the barrel. So that's cool, something story. That's important to us.
Man, it's been fun, guys.
Yeah.
It's a lot of really cool stories.
I know. Yeah. We could sit here for
how long do you think we're in at this point?
Oh, shoot. I don't even know.
I don't want to guess how much.
Andy, you got to go get kids from daycare.
Yeah, Andy's got to
pick up. He's like, oh, shoot.
Yeah. I mean, I think we could sit here and talk all day about it, and we appreciate the opportunity that you guys have given us to tell our story, because, you know, that's what it's about. You know, that's what it's about. If we can all lift each other up and be able to promote that, I think it's good for our brand, but it's good for our industry and the industry that we all really want to support and that we love.
100%.
We appreciate you guys coming.
Cool. Yeah, it's a, you know, a little bit of a hike for you guys to get down here, but we're always excited to get a load of beef. So that's awesome.
You'll get all of it next time, I promise. All
right. Yeah. Once we hire that kid.
Yeah, get that kid. Yeah, we'll clean that up. So I appreciate your patience.
I'll take you up on that. So, man, to close out, we've been talking a lot about the drinks and the distillery and so on and so forth. There's another outfit that we work with a little bit, Doug Trainer up in West Point. You guys familiar with Doug at all?
Oh, does he do Cooper's Chase?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Big
fans. So talking
fans.
Of speakeasy.
Yeah. So we've got this cool table that my buddy built. This company, Charred Chisel, made this flag for us. Folks can find them online, too. They make some really cool stuff. But in here, you might have to grab those cups, too.
No, right? I grabbed
them. No, there's shot glasses. Andy's prepared.
Andy's on it.
Oh, that is cool.
Boom.
There we go.
So in the little hidden compartment, which someday your guys' stuff's going to land in here.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We will look forward to it.
You know what I mean? So we've got Doug's vodka and Doug's bourbon. And then also from the Handlebend Boys, a couple of custom mugs that fit down in our little cool spot here.
There we go.
Awesome. Hand those over to you guys. We're going to have ourselves a little.
Yes, sir.
That,
so if you want one, you get to pick.
Oh,
if you guys like bourbon, you could
You know,
try
after all
it.
This trashing on vodka, I think I'll do vodka. I'm sure the vodka that he does is incredible, too.
But you know what? Yeah.
It is good.
Doug's a great guy. I mean, like you said,
absolutely.
You know, mentors. He's definitely a mentor for people. And
Asha, we just need to reach out. That's the thing. Is like, I think that you get into part of your industry
really,
where you kind of you forget the people that are, you know, that you can connect with. So.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
He's an open book. Like he would share with anybody whatever you ask. You know, and his his episode is actually it's our most listened to.
One of our more popular.
Yeah, most of our downloads.
Yeah.
Well, and that's one thing I was just gonna say is I wouldn't have known who Doug was unless I listened to I listened to you guys' podcast all the time. Yep. So I was, I was, that's how I know Doug. And actually after listening to his podcast, I'm like, man, why have we not reached out to this guy? We could probably learn so much from him. So it's exciting that we can do that.
We did a couple. We did a couple with Doug too. One that we haven't released yet, didn't we?
Yeah. We still got.
And he's a cattle guy too. So I mean, he's got some great stories. But just a good dude, and makes some pretty good drinks. Got some cool stories.
Well, and that's the cool part about Nebraska is we're not the only ones who have this mindset.
Right.
There's Loop River Distillery down in St. Paul. Mm-hmm. Huge admirers of what they're doing down there because he's a farmer. He's got a grain to glass distillery down there. He started a little bit before we did, so he's got great products out there too. And then Zach from Brickway Brewing Distillery, he's helped us out. He's been a good mentor for us as well. There's a lot of, all over the country, if you looked at, there's a company that we strive to be like, Fry Ranch Distillery out of Nevada. They're doing amazing things down there. And so again, just to be a part of that industry, I think it's an honor to be a part of it. And I think that everybody in it respects each other, because we know how hard it is to not only do it financially, but to create a product and wait for that product to be as good as you want it to be and what it should be and what, give that tip of the hat to what bourbon should be.
Right, for sure.
Cheers.
Well, let's take a drink. Let's have a cheers and let's close this thing out, man.
Absolutely.
Appreciate you guys coming. Yep.
There we go.
Let's have a little taste here.
That's good stuff.
Good stuff.
Have you guys had it before?
Yeah, I think I have. Yeah. I've tried
a lot of bourbons
and all the Nebraska ones too. So
yeah.
Again, not sure. We're right up there with Kentucky, and that's the goal is to
no doubt. So. Yeah.
Wait, but where can everybody find you at?
Yeah,
I know you mentioned it earlier.
I'll give our shameless plug.
Okay, let's do it.
Upstreamfarms.com, and then just Upstream Farms at on social media, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. We're trying to get in that TikTok space, so.
We keep looking at it, too, man.
Oh, my gosh, like, I know. So that's where you can connect with us. If you want to reach out to us personally, it's just Matthew@upstreamfarms.com and Joseph.
Oh, wait, you're not going to give the phone number?
No. I would get in trouble.
I'm kidding.
And if people want to order your beef online, they just order right on the website?
Yep. Right on the website, you'll find a spot. You can just jump on there, place an order, and then Joe and I and Emmy, we're the ones that fill the orders out. So once it lands on your doorstep,
that's
you'll know it's us.
So, and lastly, obviously, we got to close out, but why Upstream? The name.
Oh, why we named Upstream? Pushing against the current, I mean, I think, like I said, new ideas on old dirt. Upstream actually literally in the Native American language that was around here translates to the people of Omaha. So we knew that a lot of people in Omaha was like that's where a lot of our customers are going to be. So that had a nod to that. We did a lot of research into coming up with our name. But like I said, I think the biggest one was we knew that we would be walking upstream when it came to doing what we were going to want to do. It wasn't just going to be floating downstream like everybody else. And it was going to be a little different. And so that's it's actually kind of fun because every time that something happens, or we get some pushback or you get that feedback that Joe's talking about, we just kind of look at our name and say, well, that's what we're doing. That's what we were expecting that
we knew it.
We knew it starting out. So that's what's going to be.
So last but not least, you guys do have some merchandise. It's on the Farm Focused website.
Absolutely.
Farmfocused.com. You can find the Upstream Farms brand there.
Yep.
Some cool hats, some cool shirts, different gear, and I'm sure we'll be expanding that before long.
Oh yeah, that graphic designer I was talking about, she's got some pretty good ideas for that stuff. Oh, yeah. So coming down the line.
Hit us up, man. Let's do it.
Support the brand, expand the brand.
There we go.
Yep, that's right. Cool. Well, I'm going to close us out with the music. You guys got anything else?
No, this is great. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
It's fun, guys.
Me.
All right. Anything? No? You good?
Later, folks. Until next time.
Here we go.